Sweeter will fit very well into this class because, of course, there are stories underlying the writing she's done. I first met Cleta a few weeks after the flood, the great flood of November 1985, and Cleta and her husband, Norman. And I had seen her poem published in the local paper, the poem about the fodder shock. And I thought, what an inspiring poem. If I were had been a victim in this flood, this poem would really give me heart.
Excuse me, but you know, a lot of people here don't know about the flood of 85.
Well,
you just...
Well, they will before the morning's over.
I bet.
They will.
Yeah.
But I'm going to let Cleta tell you about the flood. But watching what's happened to her since that time, because she had written poetry previous to the flood, but watching what's happened to her since that time has interested me because I have seen poetry become a source of inspiration for a whole county of people trying to recover from a traumatic loss, which the flood certainly caused. And I've seen so much growth in Cleta's work that we decided a year ago to publish a book of her poetry. And that decision caused more another flood of poems to be written. And so very soon we're coming out with a wonderful book called Pass With Care, which is going to be an Augusta publication, and which will be available for sale. Laura, don't poke your fingers at people. Which will be available for sale. And I think Cleta's even probably prepared to take orders for that this morning, if anybody feels they want to get in on the ground floor of a good thing. So without further comment, Cleta.
Good morning. I'm happy to come join with you all today. As Michael said, for years I had written poetry without any formal training, just as a form of expression to myself, you know. And of course I thought that it probably wasn't good enough for anyone else to read. And probably the first poem that I had published in the newspaper was about my husband's uncle, Joe Long. And there was this old swinging bridge that crosses the Dry Fork River at Hendrix. And we have an event that happens in, or we did have an event that happens in Hendrix each year called the Hick Festival. And so many children that attended the Hick Festival would come to this old swinging bridge. And it was quite an attraction, you know, to get on that bridge and bounce up and down. But it was really in bad shape, and it was dangerous. So every year, Joe would go down to look out for the people that crossed that bridge. And the townspeople would say that he just didn't want the bridge tore up. But he would always say, if I don't go down and watch that bridge, someone will get killed. So in 1984, Joe passed away, and it was almost time for the Hick Festival. And I thought, now I have to write something and put in the paper so that people will know the real reason that he watched the bridge. It really bothered me that they would say that, you know, he was just looking out for the bridge rather than the children. And so I wrote a poem about him. And I don't have these in proper order because this morning I had a flat tire and all kind of things. And I'm just totally unorganized. So you will have to give me a minute to find them. But I wanted to read that to you since this was the first one that I had nerve enough to have published. And I called it The Old Man on the Bridge. The old man sat at the end of the bridge, his countenance weathered like stone, and the children whispered the old man is mad as he chased them away with harsh tones. And the town folk all said, what business is his to sit like a king at the end of the bridge? But the old man sat on all 3 days of the fair like a troll a-guarding his bridge. Folks passed one by one, and no harm was done to the old swinging bridge or the townspeople's kids. They all said, pshaw, that old bridge won't break down. We jumped on it when we were young. The old man is just mean, and that's how it seemed to those who passed by in a steady stream. But they didn't know that once long ago, when the old man was young and quite strong, on a cold winter's night by a lantern light, how he fought the dark river to save many a life. The bridge over Dry Fork broke down with the crowd. The river was running with ice. It tore at his clothes and his body half froze as he searched all that night until none could be found. And by his great courage, just one person drowned. But the old man is gone. He won't sit there this year. You can run, you can jump if you may. If the old bridge breaks down, no one will be there. But the river's hard rocks, cold and gray. The shallow water won't cushion your fall. A tragedy, people will say. But they'll know why the old man sat at the bridge and chased the children away. And he actually pulled nearly 30 people from the river. Was on a Christmas Eve or something when he was real young, a bridge that crossed over the Dry Fork River to his parents' home. And they had been to a Christmas play at a one-room school and were going home when the bridge broke down with too many people on it. And he took all of these people that, you know, that couldn't get out on their own. He took them out. And he even ended up taking his dad out twice, because he took him out and his dad thought that his mother was still in the, his dad's wife was still in the river, and he jumped back in. In the meantime, Joe had already taken her out, and then he had to take his dad out again. But just one lady drowned, and they felt that probably, you know, a cable had hit her or something. So that was the first one.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
How old were you when you started writing poetry?
I think probably as soon as I learned to write, I would, you know, write down little things. I would say probably about 9 or something like that. When I was in third grade, I didn't start school till I was 7, so I may have been 10. A lady that taught me in third grade, fifth grade, and again in an English class in high school, thought that I, you know, had a flair for words or something like that, probably because I talk so much. But anyway, by the time I started school, I already knew how to read because I had an older brother and I had to compete with him, you know. So she saw that I was a little bored with the books that they had in school, and she would bring me ones from home. And some of those were poetry books. She encouraged me to write these things down, and I would let her see them, but I wouldn't let anyone else see them. Even my mother didn't know that I wrote these things, because we lived in an old house that had been a schoolhouse at one time, and there was this ladder that went up the wall, not stairs, ladder that went up the wall into the attic. So I'd sneak away and go up there and sit beside that flue, you know, where it was nice and warm, and write all my little things down. But my mother would have thought it was foolish, and she would have thought I was just hiding away from chores or something. So then the flood came along. I did a couple more that were published in the newspaper after nobody booed the first one, you know. So I did a few more, but really nothing that was important until after the flood. And after the flood, the editor of the newspaper came up and asked me if I would write something about our experiences that night. We live in a house that is, oh, probably, 300 yards from the river or something.
Back here.
Oh, that's the one I wrote later. Okay. And so it's, like I say, it's probably 300 yards from the river, and lots of times the water had would come up and cross our road, but it had never been up to our house. So on the day that the flood was coming, of course it had been raining for several days, I think probably for 2 weeks straight it poured down. And on the day that the flood came, we knew that the water was going to come over the road and it would pin us in till we couldn't get out to town. So we hurried out that morning and bought our groceries, and I washed my clothes because it was, you know, it was impossible to dry clothes. It had been raining for so long. So we washed the clothes, and then we hurried back home before the water came over the road. And we thought once we were in there, we were fine because the water, like I say, had never been up to the house. We wouldn't be able to get in and out for maybe 2 or 3 days or something like that. But we were, we thought we were perfectly safe. Well, that night, it, of course, just came down, like, practically all at once. And it didn't seem like it was ever going to stop because it chased us out of the house and it chased us over to the hillside and then up the hill even. And so I wrote this poem. When she asked me to write about our experiences, I wrote this poem for the newspaper. And I called it Thankful for a Fodder Shock, because that's what we ended up in. A fodder shock is just a bunch of corn stalks that you've cut and dried and took the corn off. And my husband had hauled most of them in because the cows will eat the blades off the dried blades. But he had left one that he hadn't gotten hauled in. This is at an old mountain farm that we own, not the one that we live on, but on out around the hill from where we live. But actually, we were trying to get to Joe Long's house, the man I heard about. His widow still lives there. And we were trying to get to her house, but even little streams were like rivers. And I nearly drowned in one that, as a rule, passes through a culvert this big. That night I almost drowned in it. And then when we got to another little stream that's probably 2 or 3 foot wide normally, it was like a river. There wasn't any way we could cross it. We just had to spend the night on the hillside. And she had heard about that, so she asked me to write, and I wrote this one. It was just an ordinary evening when the river was running quite high. For so many times I'd been flooded in, but my house there was snug, high, and dry. I'm safe, I said. It's been before to the trees out from my door, but never in, not even when, the flood of 54. Then just a dark, a strange new sound, with a roar unreal like a train. We peered through the windows and wondered if, could that be the sound of the rain? We grabbed on our coats and ran out with the light and stared in horror at the terrible sight of water washing our car down the lane, and up to the porch the rushing waves came. So helpless we watched as our beautiful horse, admired by all folks passing by, with his strong muscled legs and his huge body weight, drift by like a leaf on the tide. Well, we tied fast the car and the truck to the trees, grabbed a blanket and untied the dog, then off to the hills lying back of the house, through water now floating with logs. We sat in the calf barn, bare minutes passed by, till water rose even to floor. Again up the mountain we hurried away, while the rain like a spigot did pour. No shelter up here, we must travel on, to an aunt's house in old Brooklyn Heights. If my poor crippled legs will last until then, we'll be safe from the storm and the night. But the rugged old mountain seemed steeper and dark, brambles caught and I fell many times. My husband's strong arms pulled me back from the grasp of a stream that threatened great harm. We heard crash of houses and trees going down and the snap as the bridge cables gave. And I thought how we'd worked to save the old span, and my tears mingled in with the rain. That was the swinging bridge. We crossed o'er the mountain to old Rebel Run. Alas, there's no way we could cross. Though we searched up and down, the calm little stream was a torrent of wide waves tossed. Oh, where could we go from the wind and the rain that chilled us right down to our bones? Then we thought of a fodder shock left in the field way back on the mountain we'd come. So we turned and went back, and with fingers now numb, built a shelter and quickly crept in. Not a dry thread remained, and the dog shivered too as he crouched by my side in the rain. He licked off his fur and then licked at my coat, though in vain the poor dog did try. And I laughed spite of all, for I knew if I didn't, I'd surely break down and cry. Well, we prayed first the rain and the wind would stop, then we prayed for the light of the day, not knowing the path the destruction took while we waited the long night away. And with day's first roll light, we stretched our stiff legs and hiked back to our house for to see. But the sight turned us cold, for the water still ran, and the rest you wouldn't believe. It looked not our farm, the meadows were gone, and but the house so curiously stayed. Three vehicles wrecked, barn and buildings all gone, great holes marked the place of their grave. So back round the mountain we trudged once again, by now we could wade every run. But when we saw Hendricks, no one could describe, the whole town looked laying to ruin. How thankful we are that we have folks who care. When we got to a house warm and dry, they gave us their clothes and warmed us with food, and their love brought tears to our eyes. We'll never forget that night on the hill in a fodder shock, shivering and wet, but how lucky we were that we had mountains near when I read of what others have lost. We still have our lives, thank God for that, and how little the rest of the cost. I pray God will help those who suffered so great in the flood that November Eve. May we not forget them in our prayers all this year in a winter so meager and bleak. And that flood destroyed 29 counties in West Virginia. 48
people.
38 property so quickly was that it must have dammed up above and then broke loose and came all down through at one time, because it was unbelievable how that water just kept coming up and up, you know, just like it was chasing us, you know, up the side of the hill.
Are you back in your old house?
No, we built a new house. We decided that one was probably, it could have been fixed up, but we decided it would probably take more to fix the old one than it would to build a new one. So we built a new house a little higher up. There was one little spot that we had a hog pen, and the hog was all right, so we still had him to butcher. That's all. The cows were okay. They were against the hill. But the horse that was a 1,700-pound draft horse was in the barn, and it caught him, you know, real quick. And my husband had raised him from a colt, so it was, that was, we never found him. And I'm just almost as glad that we didn't, you know, because it would have been terrible if we'd found, you know, really saw him afterwards. We just hope that he died real quick, you know, and didn't suffer. So after that, I wrote several more poems to cheer people up, you know. It was really a bad time, and so mainly I wrote them for myself, selfishly enough. It was a form of therapy for me to write down, you know, things that I was thinking about. And then the editor of the Parsons Advocate said, let's put them in, you know, that people really need to hear these things. So I wrote one called Unity and Tucker. And I wrote this to read at a woman's club meeting of the Hamilton Hendricks English Club, which is a unit of the National Federation of Women's Clubs. And of course, their symbols are unity and diversity. And so I figured that this fit. When the old year sighed and shuffled out, I wasn't really sad, like years before when time closed doors on memories gay and glad. For 85 had taken toll with sickness, death, and flood, and the new year promised better things in spite of cold and mud. We'd picked us up and dusted off the feelings of defeat, and the mighty trucks of Army Corps had finally left our streets. It almost seemed spring cleaning time with folks affixing new. As lots were cleared and windows washed, hope slowly came to view. And a rumor here is whispered there about the folks who care, and even though they're miles away, they want to do their share. So trucks roll in all laden down with furniture and goods. There's clothes and gifts for everyone, and no one lacks for food. The stores began to open. It's like first day of school. We rush to buy the little things, and tension starts to cool. For the things we took for granted all too suddenly were gone, and we realized how much we had but never pondered on. We never told our neighbors, I'm glad you live next door. We never told the business folk, I like to shop your store. We never took the time to say the things that really count. We couldn't vision losing time until the clock ran out. But now we've traveled trouble's road. We've struggled and survived. So let's all try and kinder be to those who pass us by. Just greet your neighbor with a hug, speak out to friend and foe, and thank the Lord for what we have, the good will surely grow. And spring holds forth a promise of blue skies and flowers grand. The sun will shine and grass will grow to hide the mud and sand. The river then won't seem so cruel as summer warms the soul. Its waters clear will beckon us to swim in rippling pools. So let's just put the past behind and look to brighter days. And thanks to all who cared enough to help us on our way. For Tucker County people might falter for a while, but proud we are, and soon you'll see the unity and diversity. But there were bad times. This time in particular, we had the site dozed off, you know, for a new house. And we thought it was perfectly dry because there had never been any water there before, and we thought it was perfectly dry. So we paid a fellow something like $200 or $300, you know, to doze off the site for the new house. And we went back a couple days later, and there were four wet weather springs just gushing. So we were kind of discouraged, to say the least. And I went down by the river, and I wrote this poem, because I always take my book with me, you know. And I called it My Escape. Have you ever felt so discouraged that you just said to hell with it all and sat down on a rock at the river's edge and glared at the mountains tall? The smell of the river invades your soul, and the wind whips hair in your eyes. The soft sand squiggles between your toes, and a lazy old bass swims by. And you feel so alone in a world that's filled with more problems than anything else. The joy is gone, and no one cares. Nobody cares that you're sitting alone on life's shelf. But suddenly the cat brushes soft by your leg with a purr that says, I love you, and demands that you make a lap of your legs for a friend who will sit there too. With a paw on your cheek, claws carefully concealed, he brushes a stray tear aside, then curls his body so warm in your lap, and at peace closes yellow-green eyes. A cloud passes over and covers the sun, but you don't feel the slight breeze's chill, for the dog too has come and laid down by your side, head on paws and perfectly still. A tiny bird hops a few feet away, head cocked with questioning eyes. A butterfly circles with gold wings outspread as she looks for a place to light. And it's then you realize you're not alone. God sent his creatures to care for the hurt in your heart and the spirit so low, the problems of life they will share. His perfect peace will restore the joy and give a new lift to your soul. The comfort that comes from nature's own scene won't leave room for a self-pity hole. So you pick yourself up and dust off the sand. Cat and dog race ahead down the path. And you're glad that you had silent talk with the Lord. You can now face the world with a laugh. And since then, I have written, you know, gobs of them. And like I say, for this book. And in particularly, I write about all kind of subjects. I really don't need too much of a push to write these things. Sometimes I just look out and see things, you know. And so the other morning, well, this has been a couple weeks ago because I haven't typed this one up yet, I looked out the bathroom window and there was a bumblebee caught in the spider's web. So I wrote this about the battle. This morning I saw a bumblebee caught in a spider's web, and the more he struggled to loosen his bonds, the tighter they closed instead. And the tiny spider sat waiting as the bee shook him to and fro. Then he darted down with a new sticky strand, tacking fast the ones that let go. Well, I felt empathy for the struggling bee, but the spider I had to admire. With a prey 6 times as big as himself, I watched as they parried and sparred. And I once thought the battle all ended, for the bee was hopelessly tied. Then he struggled with a newfound frenzy and pulled his wings open wide. Oh, who would be victor, I wondered? In this battle, each struggled to win, so much like the torturous tangle that binds up the souls of men. Well, I couldn't watch any longer, and I left fate to figure the cost. But when I looked out this morning, I saw that the bee had lost. I might even just look out and see some clouds in the sky, you know, that I think are a little strange. And sometimes I write about those, so I have one I call cloud walking. By the way, I have a muscular dystrophy type disease that sort of, you know, holds me in one spot when I want to do so many things. So I'm kind of limited in that. A lot of this sort of comes through with that. I call this one cloud walking. There's a calm in the sky this evening, with clouds all ruffled like lace, layered in shades of white to gray, seeming to hold in one place. From mountain to mountain, some layers span the space, while others are broken midway. And the pink of the sun shines velvety red behind the border of gray. And I wonder how it would feel to walk with him soothing the side of my cheek. Would it feel like the mist of a damp morning fog made warm by a hot asphalt street? Or would it be cold like the wind-whirled snow that blinds your sight for a time and makes you turn your back to the gale, so bitter, so cruel and unkind? Would they smell of a pine treetop fragrance or punish your senses like smoke? Would they part a path if you walked inside or wrap you in soft white cloak? Oh, I long to experience so many things that mortal can never attain, with body by earth's magnet grounded and mind on a cloud-scudded plane. So I really don't need too much to cost me to write. There's this show that's on our TV locally or something I forget what it is. It's Siskel and something. Anyway, they review movies, you know. And when they finish this show, they always say that the balcony is, well, maybe, they always say the balcony is closed. And I've got the wrong poem, I guess. That's the one I was going to read to you. Now I don't know where it's at. And like I was telling you before, I sometimes get upset at myself because of this muscular disease. So I wrote this one to make me feel better. And you'll have to come back another time to hear the one about the balconies already closed. I called this one Unlooking Down. Not everyone's granted the privilege of seeing life as I do. Since I have to watch carefully where I walk, field of vision begins at my shoes. Now, I might miss the flight of a beautiful bird as it soars high up in the sky, but I see the gold green of the monarch's cocoon dangling under a plant I pass by. And I might not see the rainbow's path that leads to proverbial gold, but I find the four-leaf clover and the promise of luck that it holds. I might miss the cloud's silver lining, but I see the glitter of dew as it kisses the petals of daisies and sparkles on spider webs new. I might miss the star-studded heavens as I plod along eyes on feet, but I'm sure my head will be lifted when I walk past where earth and sky meet. And this one I called it my way. I was really feeling defined here. I'm only a backwoodsy poet. My training is rather oblique, not aimed at a risk-free parallel or the goals that so many seek. My style is simple and open. The meaning is free to the ear with emotion-provoking lyrics that bubble up laughter or tears. I'll never be quoted or known, but God, it sure feels great to write about life as I find it and torture the hand of fate. I'll not wait in the wings for paralysis. To hell with the script as planned. I'll write it my way as long as the play brings cheer to the heart of man. I'm very impulsive, and sometimes I jump into things and I do things, and my husband is kind of a mountain man. He would be totally uncomfortable in this group. He couldn't stand it. He'd have to go get air. He's a real mountain man, you know what I mean? After being married to him for 32 years, it doesn't really bother me that he doesn't like the same things I do. And so he would rather go ginseng or fishing or mountain climbing and a lot of those things that I can't do anymore. As a matter of fact, this place where we spent the night of the flood, he had, of course, raised crops out there, and all summer long he'd say to me, "Cleta, come go out with me," and I'd say, "Oh, Norman, I can't walk all the way up that hill." Well, that night I didn't need any urging. But it probably is close to between 2 and 3 miles around that mountain, so by the time we finally gave up and got to the fodder shock, I was exhausted. But anyway, sometimes I jump into things, and he's sort of like my rock. He's there to keep me grounded. And I wrote this one for him, and I called it The Steady Force. You keep me at ground level when the wind catches neath my wings. You deflate my soaring ego when it grows to a frightful thing. And sometimes I resent your millstone when I feel I've missed my mark. The lofty heights elude me while you drag against my heart. You slow my steps to stardom, keep my finish line in sight, when common sense and reason have all but taken flight. And your reasoning is the only claim that causes me to pause and settle back into my sphere when nights of darkness call. So he always...
How did you read that to him? I mean, how did he feel being a mountainy man when you said, "Hey, I've written this about you"? What did he say? Or
he said, "What do you mean, nights of darkness?" Because I spelled it K-N-I-G-H-T-S, you know, nights
yes.
of darkness.
Yes.
And I was referring to bad things, you know, things that you really need to stop and look at twice, because sometimes I... you know, if people flatter me, I just follow them anywhere. And sometimes I trust people too much, and I, you know, I end up getting my feelings hurt and that sort of thing. Norman is a very good judge of character, and usually the first time he meets someone, he'll say, "Now that person is, you know, not the right kind of person." But I don't know that. And once I had a grocery store, and he told me, he said, "Now, you shouldn't let those people have stuff on credit, you know, food on credit." And I said, "Oh, they'll pay me." You know, they paid me every month. They would come and pay me what they owed. And finally, this last month, they bought about $1,100 worth of groceries and just split. So he was right the first time around. I wrote this one, and... it was one of those times when I was thinking to myself, why didn't I take time, you know, to put things up or grab things, you know, that night before the flood? It was so silly, because the water Well, the water was at different levels in our house, and like maybe one place it was 4 foot, another place it was 5 foot, and then where it hit came in so hard that it hit the wall and sort of slapped up the wall, it, you know, went way up. So nearly everything downstairs was ruined, and almost everything was downstairs because I couldn't get up and downstairs very well, you know, so we had a spare bed, a bedroom suit upstairs, and a few other odds and ends, but really not much of anything left up there. But sometimes you think about, well, why didn't I do this or why didn't I do that? You know, just even if I'd just thrown something upstairs, just throwed it up the stairwell, it would have been saved. And I had thrown the photograph albums in on the bed when we left because I thought the water might, you know, get in the house on the floor. And the photograph albums were on the bottom shelf of the television stand. And I threw those in on the bed, and the mattress floated up to the ceiling and kept them dry. So I was really fortunate that I had. Of course, I lost a lot of photographs that weren't in that album. But this was a year afterwards that I wrote this. And it was one of those times when I was feeling like kicking myself because I didn't put something away. A year has gone by since that angry night when we fled for our lives up the hill and sheltered in a fodder shock while the valley with water did fill. And for a long time I tortured myself with what ifs and why didn't I do this or that instead of just run. And sometimes in the night I would cry for the loss of a kitten or a big horse named Clyde or a silly sentimental thing like a baby picture or lock of hair and my first worn-out wedding ring. And I wondered why God let this awful thing happen to people like us, who'd worked so hard for what we had, and it nearly shook my trust. But then I remembered my daddy, a smiling, gentle man. He lived his life one day at a time, according to the Master's plan. And he always put God's will up front, no matter temptations bid. And when he died in 71, that legacy he willed to us kids. So I stood at the mirror and yelled at myself, "Don't you ever question God's will. The things that you lost are like nothing compared to the ones whose loved ones were killed." Well, I shook off the fetters of silly regret, and I started sentiment anew. There's a coin we found the night of the flood, and letters from friends so true. And so if you lost baby's first shoes, be thankful you still had the feet. And if you lost wedding ring, pictures and rings, be thankful you still have the real thing. And the memories of good times before the flood and afterwards the caring we saw from folks far and near will always be here to lift us whenever we fall. So, like I said, this was a way of my getting things out of my system too. A friend of ours, I don't know if you've heard of him or not, John Warner, he's a marvelous photographer. And since I've got you crying, I'll do this one too. He took a photograph after the flood of a cow wedged up in under the St. George Bridge. And, I mean, it just says so much because that bridge was so high up. And for this cow to actually be shoved up under the framing up underneath the bridge. That was probably, 40 feet above the water. And it was so swift that it jammed the cowl and all this garbage and everything up in there. And he took a photograph of that. And it's really a famous photograph. It's been in Los Angeles and all over the place. He sold tons of copies of it. But when I saw that picture, you know, it about did me in. And I said to him, why in the world do people think that's such a marvelous photograph? Because to me it was, ugh. And I worried that I hurt his feelings because he went, you know, he thought it was a great photograph too, in the sense that it said it all, he thought, you know. Well, after I said that to him, why do people think that's a great photograph? I worried that maybe I hurt his feelings because he's very sensitive. So I wrote this poem for him, and I called it Cheat's Bounty because this bridge crossed the Cheat River. It's a once-in-a-lifetime photograph, but the camera's eye didn't see the scope of the photographer's hurt that is so apparent to me. Folks viewed with shock the hapless cow caught in a mechanical web and marveled at the mighty force that left it there in the ebb. But when I look at this photograph, I see a different sight. It's a culmination of all the pain and the fury that came in the night. I feel the crush of the water so swift, and I see the fright in her eyes. And I hear that final desperate call, and oh God, I wonder why. And it's not just the cows that haunt me. It's a life's work, a home and a man. It's the animals, the land, and the beauty, and the hopes it left dashed in the sand. I see the tears in the eyes that beheld and feel the swell of his heart. I feel the insignificant size of mortal in what God has wrought. And that's why this magnificent photograph that says more than volumes can say, so horrible and vivid I can't look upon, will surely be famous one day. I wrote that as an explanation for him why I felt like I did, because. The patchwork, yeah, I had it right here. I was working on a quilt whenever the flood came, and I had all these pieces in my little basket here, you know, beside the chair. And so afterwards, I washed the mud out of some of these pieces, and I sort of likened that quilt to you know, the plan for life. So, well, this poem is self-explanatory. I called it The Quilt of Life. There's an unfinished quilt at my house because the flood washed the pieces away. I cleaned the mud from the part that was left with intent to finish it someday. And I spread it all out every once in a while when I come across cloth thought to match, then fold it back up and put it away for the lack of a suitable patch. For this piece is too dark or maybe too light, and the thickness might not be the same. The weave is too loose or maybe too close, and the quilt unfinished remains. But it serves to remind me when I grow sad about sorry hand fate has dealt, of the patchwork of life with the pattern unclear until we have finished the quilt. For one square is dark as a storm cloud shade, and one is as bright as new pin. But we need both the dark and the shiny bright to make the whole pattern blend. And even the colors won't hold all in place, for the shapes might not be the same. Like the crazy quilt that Grandma made, life often has edges to tame. But God planned life's quilt with the greatest of care, like every good quilt maker does. And though he put in rough edges to trim, it will cover us safely with love. And the quilt at my house that flood ruined for a while might lay on the shelf many days, but sooner or later I'll fit pieces in, and the quilt will warm us, I pray. By the way, I haven't finished it yet. I'm still working on it. I'll read you a funny one now to help you feel better. Now, what did we do with the one? I wrote this one for Fran. She was talking one day about, what were you talking about? Tell me what you were talking
about. Calories and carbohydrates?
Yeah.
How many calories?
So she called me up and she said,
the cholesterol.
Why don't you write a poem about the way things were before? So I wrote this one. Remember how simple life was before the world was made aware of the many new discoveries that caused staunchest hearts to scare. We fried our eggs, piled butter thick, and ate our toast with jam. Poured maple syrup on hot cakes and never trimmed the ham. We used real cream in our coffee, and sugar wasn't a threat. We salted extra if we pleased, and no one seemed to fret. We never counted calories or jogged our time away. We drank untreated water and stayed in the sun all day. If you had mentioned pollution, folks would have thought you strange. We'd never heard of nuclear waste or something called acid rain. The ozone layer was outer space. Cholesterol, a physician's word. We smoked and chewed and sipped homemade booze. Of botulism, we'd never heard. We drank boneset tea for pneumonia. put apple butter on a burn, chewed yellow root for the sore throat before penicillin was learned. We fed the baby catnip tea if colic made him cry. We dusted on lots of cornstarch to keep him soft and dry. We killed the bugs with kerosene, ate apples straight from the tree. We'd never heard of phlebitis, so we often crossed our knees. Well, I'm sure some folks had heart attacks and cancer in those times, but it isn't it strange that we didn't know the 7 warning sign? Now, I think folks live longer then, despite what statistics say, and ignorance was surely bliss back in the good old days.
It all came about because I was disgusted counting calories.
And
after my talks, club members.
Sometimes we listen to TV and there's things that scare us, and so I wrote this poem I call my ostrich poem. You know, we stick our head in the sand. The world today is a bitter place with hassles on every hand and problems so heavy they shake the faith of many a God-fearing man. There's a nuclear threat hanging over our head like a cloud storm-filled and thick, and issues much too complex for Teddy's walk softly and carry a stick. And so much of our time is spent stroking the fur of a tiger that sits growling low. And if we stop now, that tiger might spring to heights we don't even know. An election year looms like a wave poised to break with a crash on the sand of our times. Holy men now are caught in the tow, and church over state is the chime. Oh, how did we come to this sorry state? Is this progress or am I a fool? But I'm glad as I sit and ponder affairs that someone else makes the rules. I'll just hide from it. Am I running out of time?
No.
Oh, okay, well, tell me if I'm going on too long.
But I want to mention to you that I'm sure many of us would love to buy a copy of your book when it comes out.
Oh, well,
so
great.
Have a sheet for us to write our names and address and so on.
Yes, I do.
I know that we really, don't forget, because I'd
okay,
like you to
sure.
Pen, like I said.
Since we're talking,